From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This week, Richard Ford received a Pulitzer Prize for his novel Independence Day. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we listen back to our interview with Ford about the book. Musician and record producer Don Was paid tribute to one of his heroes, Brian Wilson, by making a movie about him. That documentary, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, has just come out on video. We'll hear from Don Was and listen to the music from the companion CD. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The prices we pay jumped 0.4% in last month. It was the steepest one-month gain in the Consumer Price Index in over 5 years. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The relatively large increase in prices was fueled by big jumps in food and energy costs, both of which were at least partially responses to unseasonably cold weather. But there were increases in other areas as well. Even after factoring out the volatile food and energy sectors, the core rate of inflation, the one watched most closely, increased 0.3%. So far this year, consumer prices are rising at a 4% annual rate. That's significantly faster than the 2.5% rate for all of 1995. Concern about increasing inflation has motivated investors to push up long-term interest rates almost a full percentage point since the beginning of the year. Though March inflation was slightly higher than expected, investors were unshaken and actually sent interest rates down after the report was released. I'm John Itzty in Washington.
Japan and the U.S. have announced that a U.S. airbase on Okinawa will be shut down within 5 to 7 years and the land returned to its owners. U.S. Ambassador to Japan Walter Mondale said many other significant steps will also be announced in the next few days to make the American military presence in Japan less intrusive. Details of those steps will be announced during President Clinton's visit to Japan next week. Calls for a reduced U.S. military presence on Okinawa were sparked by the rape of a Japanese schoolgirl there last fall. 3 U.S. servicemen were convicted in that assault. Israeli helicopters and warplanes struck positions throughout Lebanon for a second straight day. NPR's Suni Khalid reports from Beirut.
Most of today's attacks were directed against southern Lebanon in the Syrian-controlled Bekaa Valley. Israel advised residents of 40 villages in southern Lebanon to evacuate their homes until later in the day. This is in response to continued Hezbollah rocket attacks on northern Israel. In Beirut, at least 3 Israeli Apache helicopter gunships attacked a Syrian military position just north of the international airport. Smoke was seen rising from the position, and 1 Syrian soldier was reportedly killed. Israel later denied that they were deliberately targeting Syrian military positions. I'm Suni Khalid in Beirut.
The estate of former President Richard M. Nixon has agreed to release almost 3,700 hours of tapes made during his years in the White House. Many relate to the Watergate scandal that ended his presidency. Until now, only 63 hours of Nixon tapes had been made public. The first of the new tapes will be released next fall. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 25.25 points at 5,512 in heavy trading of 183 million shares. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite Index is up just over 3 points. This is NPR News. A spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says the UN will try to evacuate nearly 100 UN workers from Liberia by sea. The U.S. military is continuing helicopter evacuations from Monrovia today. More than 900 people have been airlifted out so far since the fighting in Liberia began last weekend. A new report from the Southern Poverty Law Center warns that militia groups in the U.S. are more dangerous than ever now. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
The Southern Poverty Law Center report, False Patriots, the Threat of Anti-Government Extremists, warns that it's only a matter of time before the country endures another nightmare like the Oklahoma City tragedy. The Montgomery, Alabama Center, which tracks militia groups and hate crimes, is urging Attorney General Janet Reno to create a joint federal-state task force to squelch militia violence. It also recommends new laws, including tighter restrictions on the purchase of bomb-making chemicals and on militia membership. Center officials say their top recommendation is that states begin enforcing existing anti-militia laws. The report indicates groups aligned with the militant Patriot movement are far more widespread than previously believed. This is Debbie Elliott reporting.
Bernhard Goetz has taken the witness stand in the $50 million civil lawsuit against him in New York. Goetz shot four young black men on a New York subway train in 1984 after they asked him for money. He's being sued by one of those young men, now 30, who suffered brain damage and is partially paralyzed. Jessica Dubroff's mother is defending her decision to allow the 7-year-old to make the cross-country plane flight that ended in tragedy yesterday. Lisa Blair Hathaway told NBC she wanted her daughter to have freedom and choice and not to be forbidden from doing adventurous things. The girl died yesterday when the plane she was piloting crashed on takeoff in Wyoming. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Columbia Records and its new album releases, Dead Man Walking, music from and inspired by the motion picture, and the companion piece, Dead Man Walking, the score.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Richard Ford won a Pulitzer Prize this week for his novel Independence Day. On this archive edition, to help you get better acquainted with this book and its author, we'll hear a review from our critic Maureen Corrigan, and we'll feature an interview with writer Richard Ford, both recorded a year ago when the novel was published. Independence Day is a sequel to Ford's acclaimed 1986 novel, The Sports Writer. Independence Day takes place in 1988, and the main character, Frank Bascom, is 44 years old. Frank has entered what he calls the existence period of his life, a time when transcendent yearnings are punctuated by practical worries. Here's a short passage from the opening, read by the author Richard Ford, in which Frank describes other aspects of the existence period.
A sad fact, of course, about adult life is that you see the very things you'll never adapt to coming towards you on the horizon. You see them as the problems they are, you worry like hell about them, you make provisions, take precautions, fashion adjustments. You tell yourself you'll have to change your way of doing things, only you don't. You can't. Somehow it's already too late. And maybe it's even worse than that. Maybe the thing you see coming from far away is not the real thing, the thing that scares you, but its aftermath. And what you feared will happen has already taken place. And in that very way, your life gets over before you know it. We miss it. And like the poet said, the ways we miss our lives are life.
There's a voice I never expected to hear again. Not Richard Ford's, but Frank Bascom's. Frank was the fallen hero of Ford's 1986 novel, The Sports Writer, one of the most moving books ever written about divorce and loss and the nobility, as well as the absurdity, of just plodding along. You don't usually think of great works of literature as spawning sequels. Part of what supposedly makes them great is that they create complete worlds in themselves. But some fictional characters, like Huck Finn or Philip Marlowe or Frank Bascom, lead such unruly, rich lives that they can barely be contained within the space of one book. They all but demand encores to round out their stories. As the passage you just heard suggests, in the years since his last appearance, Frank hasn't gotten religion or optimism or Prozac. When Independence Day begins, he's still the same gloomy, courageously aware guy he was in The Sports Writer. Frank has returned to New Jersey from a brief fling in France, and he's traded in sports writing for real estate brokering. The job suits him because he has an intimate knowledge of the contingencies of life that uproot people. Frank's ex-wife, Anne, has remarried to a hale and hearty architect Frank loathes. And their 15-year-old son, Paul, has grown into a disturbed delinquent. He sometimes barks uncontrollably and has recently been arrested for shoplifting condoms. Frank desperately wants to believe that a father-son road trip to the basketball and baseball halls of fame might provide the opportunity for Paul to open up to his old dad. In The Sports Writer, Frank's resurrection from the deadening grief of his divorce took place over Easter week. Here, it's the July 4th holiday that gives symbolic definition to the story. Mixing up the Declaration of Independence with the Constitution, Frank tells Paul that The original framers wanted to be free to make new mistakes. That's the very freedom these two men seek as they drive towards historic Cooperstown and become part of a centuries-old traffic flow of Americans searching for something elusive and better beyond a distant hill. And Frank and Paul find it. I can't think of another American novelist besides Richard Ford who could write such an unsentimental, funny, and profound story about a man who's old enough to know better regaining the courage to hope. It's as though Fitzgerald had decided to let Jay Gatsby have a second try at reaching that green light.
Independence Day by Richard Ford won a Pulitzer Prize this week. Maureen Corrigan's review was recorded a year ago when the book was published. Last June, I talked with Richard Ford about the book. Why did you decide to bring back Frank Bascom after your 1986 novel, A Sports Writer?
Because, and I certainly never intended to do it, I thought I had closed down all the sets on that last book and that he would speak no more. But in fact, in my notebooks in the years about 89, 90, 91, I found that I started writing in notes in my notebook in his voice, and I resisted a long time because I didn't particularly want to start thinking about a new book with Frank as its narrator again, but it just was the case that I kept looking at the world, in essence, through his fictive eyes. And finally, there was just a preponderance of notes in my notebook, and I had finished another book called Wildlife, and it was in essence, finished out of my life, and I was sort of without work to do. I'd written two novellas, and I wanted to write a novel. And I looked around and saw what I had, and I had all of this stuff, and I resisted it for a year because I thought there were a lot of pitfalls to writing a sequel, and worked and worked and worked trying to see if I really had enough stuff, and it just finally became evident that I did have enough stuff, and that's kind of, you know, what Henry James used to call a done. I'm not sure if James exactly meant that, but I felt I was given all of this stuff, and that's what a writer has to start with, what you're given, and I was given a lot of material.
Frank was a sports writer in The Sports Writer, and now he's a realtor.
Right.
In your new book, it seems to me that's an interesting profession to give a main character because people are so hopeful and imaginative when they're buying a house. I mean, this house is either going to change their lives for the better or maybe ruin their lives with the mortgage. So it's a situation in life when you're always imagining how this big decision is going to totally change the course of your life.
Exactly, exactly. Finding shelter for people is, I think, one of the most primary things we can do for each other. And as the book stipulates, where a person buys a house determines where they'll be happy and where they'll be unhappy and what windows they'll look out of and where they'll come home after funerals and divorces and weddings and things like that. It seems to be sort of first principle for human happiness, where people live.
You know what I thought was interesting? Frank has a son in this book, a teenage son of 15, who has begun to go astray. The son has been arrested for shoplifting condoms, and he started fighting with the security guards when they tried to nail him. And this is the third book I've read this season by important writers who I really like, who have sons in the book that are going astray: Scott Spencer, Russell Banks, and yourself. And I wonder if you think that means anything.
I don't know, because I don't have any kids.
Well, I found that interesting too. That you know, you'd be writing about a father so carefully, not being a father yourself.
Well, I guess. One of the things that interests me as a writer is families, and if you're going to write about families, you're constantly looking for sources of drama within families. And since I was kind of a bad kid myself and was more than once caught for shoplifting, it kind of came naturally to me to write about a kid who was shoplifting. I had some personal experience, and I also knew the distress it caused my parents for kids to get caught doing what they're not supposed to be doing like that. So even though it didn't happen to me as a father, it happened to me as a son, and so it was natural to come up into my mind.
Your father, I think he died when you were about 16.
Right.
I know during some of his life he was a salesman. I believe he sold starch.
Exactly.
On the road. Was he the kind of salesman who had to survive on his verbal skills to convince his clients to buy something, or was he not that kind of salesman?
Well, that's a funny thing you should ask, because part of his territory was down in what they used to call the Evangeline Country, which is over on the west side of the Atchafalaya River in Louisiana, and where in the 50s at least, and probably still today, people spoke French, and that patois French, and he would go into these little towns like Thibodeau and Ville Platte and St. Francisville, and he would go in there and I think kind of sell himself to people who he didn't share a language with, but I think he would kind of fake it sometimes. He would sort of speak to them in a patois of his own, and they would speak back to him. And basically, what he did was sell himself to them by not so much his verbal skills, but by his willingness to try.
Did you ever watch him in action on the road?
Many times. Many times. In fact, I can still drive over there, particularly also up in the Delta in Mississippi, where I sometimes live. I can go back to those places where he traveled, and he used to take me inside these wholesale grocery company warehouses, and I would just stand beside him as he would do his business. And as I say, I can go back to those places now. There, some of them are still around. It's quite memorable to me.
What was it like growing up knowing that your father sold starch? I mean, starch isn't a really big part of a young person's life.
Starch is not too sexy.
No.
Well, it was the only job he ever had. And we thought, my family used to always say that my father was a guy who had a job during the Depression. He got a job working for the same company, the Faultless Starch Company in Kansas City, Missouri, the same company that Huey Long used to sell starch for in the 20s. And they were always so thrilled, my mother and father, that he had kept his job through the 30s and through the 40s and through the 50s. And the fact that he sold starch rather than, something more high profile or appealing never was an issue in our life at all. I think maybe amongst his salesman pals, there was a lot of joking about starch. You know, there's salesmen, I guess the idea of a traveling salesman joke still doesn't exist anymore. But I'm sure there were a lot of nice bawdy jokes about selling starch. And you can imagine.
See where you're leading.
You can imagine,
yes,
what they would be about. and I think that was a source of humor. My father was a very mirthful guy. So I think he thought selling starch was his job. And he came out of a time in American life when if you had a job, you didn't question what kind. Upward mobility was not really a matter of choosing among a lot of alternatives. He had a job. He loved it. He worked hard at it. And that was it. I think in a way, frankly, that has led me to some of the preoccupations of my own work, which is not surprising. A character really doesn't become workable for me. And I don't want to say real, because characters never really become real for me, but a character doesn't become workable for me until I can posit what it is she or he does for a living.
Mm-hmm.
And once I get that little anchorage established in a character's the sort of fascicle of life that they have, then I can begin to imagine them more completely.
We're featuring an interview with Richard Ford, recorded last June. His novel Independence Day won a Pulitzer Prize this week. Back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer Richard Ford. When your father died when you were 16, did you become like a more responsible person then, or did you get into more trouble in the short period right afterwards?
No, I had been in a lot of trouble in the short period just before. And it's a very peculiar thing in a sense. I had gotten in trouble with the police for stealing with a pal of mine in Little Rock, or rather in Jackson, where I grew up, in Mississippi. And my father was a traveling salesman, and so he was gone a lot and come home on the weekends. And my mother always tried to make the weekends be rather nice. And the affairs of daily life were sort of set aside while my father was home. But when I got in trouble with the police, my father had to come along and take an interest in this. And he was, I remember, so kind about it. He said to me, well, he said, you know, this is bad, and you're going to have to be on probation, and you got to go to court and things like that. And but I remember very distinctly, and my mother was the same. I don't want to include her out of this, but he was extremely sympathetic to me. He sort of seemed to know that what I was doing was not good, that it wasn't the worst thing. And then 2 weeks after this happened, he died. And that's what it left me with, his death. It left me with a sort of conviction that I had to do more right than I had been doing up to date. And so I actually kind of started getting my act together, because my mother said to me after my father died, she said, you know, I'm going to have to go to work now. You're 16 years old. You're going to have to take care of yourself a lot more than you've been taking care of yourself. And so that was true. I knew it was true. And so I did.
Did you have to get a job?
Well, I had a job.
Uh-huh.
We worked.
What'd you do?
Oh, I sat groceries at the A&P, and I did all the things that boys could do in those days. I did everything that I could do to earn some money. I mean, and I don't want to misrepresent our life. It wasn't that we were poor, because we weren't, but it would have never occurred to me, nor would it have ever occurred to my family, that when I got above 14, which was the age that when you could go to work, that I wouldn't have a job. I just did.
I know you spent some time, I guess maybe this was after your father's death, living with your grandparents.
Right.
Who, did they own a motel or run a motel?
They ran a big hotel in Little Rock. And after my father died, actually quite a while before he died, because he had been sick with heart trouble for years before that, I spent a lot of my growing up period, particularly in the summers, in the Marion Hotel in Little Rock, Arkansas, and for a period of adolescence, that's quite a risque place to grow up.
Did were risque because there's a lot of people who go there for their quickie afternoon flings? Or?
That and just a lot of general license occurs in a hotel. It was a big hotel. It's gone now. They imploded it in Little Rock back about 20 years ago. They wouldn't do it now because it was a wonderful old building. But all kinds of political shenanigans and the quick afternoon stop off. But also a good deal of violence. People going into hotel rooms and committing murders, and going into hotel rooms committing suicides and fights. All kinds of mayhem.
Well, this must have made you think that life was very eventful.
Yes, it did, actually. And I loved it. Consequently, I loved to go there. Every time I could get a chance, I would go up to Little Rock and stay with my grandparents, because you never could tell what was going to happen.
What I find particularly intriguing about this is that one of the things I've always liked about hotels and motels is that, well, at their best, they're a way to get some respite from regular life. You're in this kind of limbo, you know, and someone comes in and cleans your room and makes the bed and...
Exactly.
All the responsibilities that come with having an apartment or a house, you don't have while you're in this hotel.
That's exactly right.
And you're probably removed from everything else in your life also, unless you're at a business conference.
That's exactly right.
So to live in that environment where everybody around you has gotten away from regular life, but that is your regular life, is pretty interesting.
Well, it creates in you a kind of dual sense of permanence and transience, equally competing for a persuasive power in your life.
Right.
And it did me, in fact. I mean, I don't know if there's any time in the life that I'm happier than the first 25 minutes after I've checked into a hotel. As you say, all of those things that you just described, all of those senses of irresponsibility and come down on you wonderfully. Christina and I think that... one of the things that we do is in Montana is that we go hunting sometimes, and we just stay in little cheap motels way out in the middle of nowhere, and I think it's the happiest we ever are. for the very reasons that you say.
Now, did you have a writer's interest in imagining the lives of all the people staying at the hotel while you were there?
Well, I didn't have to imagine it.
Right.
I was the manager's son.
Oh,
I could,
right.
If I wanted to know what they were doing, I could jolly well find out what they were doing, because I knew all the bellboys. I knew all the maids. One of my first jobs was to be a room service waiter. And can you imagine what a 17-year-old room service waiter sees?
What do you see?
Well, you see the governor sometimes where he's not supposed to be. You see the head of the highway patrol sometimes where he's not supposed to be. And it was always strange, because I would... This was not even in my grandfather's hotel, but another hotel. I really grew up in the hotel business in that sense. And I was kind of a naive kid in some ways, and I would sometimes take somebody's breakfast to their rooms, and the man who opened the door would be a man I knew. And maybe he wouldn't recognize me right away as being the kid with the white jacket on. But something in me always made him say, "Oh, hi, Mr. So-and-so. Remember me? I'm Richard Ford. I'm Ben Shelley's grandson." And there was always kind of an awful moment, which I finally, by dint of repetition, quit doing. but I couldn't resist when I saw somebody I recognized saying hello and introducing myself. I guess I'm my father's son in that way.
Did you know the meaning of the word discretion when when you were at the hotel?
No, I didn't know. But I learned it, though.
Did the people ever pay you not to say anything?
No. No, they may have wished they had later, when they saw books that I wrote 25 years later, in which their lives were perhaps reflected. Though I never used anybody's name. Yes, I learned discretion.
Richard Ford, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure entirely.
Richard Ford recorded last June. His novel Independence Day won a Pulitzer Prize this week. The paperback edition will be published at the end of this month by Vintage, which is also bringing out new paperback editions of five of his earlier books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. And from Harper San Francisco, publisher of the illustrated World's Religions by religion historian Houston Smith. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the genius of Brian Wilson. We hear from record producer Don Was. His documentary about Wilson, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, is now out on video.
Well, East Coast girls are hip, I really dig those styles they wear. And the Southern girls with the way they talk, I'm down there. The Midwest.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A top record producer paid homage to a pop music genius in the film I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. The documentary is about Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. He was their lead vocalist, songwriter, arranger, and producer. Although their early songs sang of fun, 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 Brian Wilson has had terrible depressions and nervous breakdowns. The documentary tries to make connections between his life and his songs. It just came out on video, so on this archive edition, we feature an interview with the director, Don Was. He's best known for the successful records he's produced for Bonnie Raitt, the Rolling Stones, and the B-52s. He used to co-lead the band Was Not Was. He and Brian Wilson co-produced a CD companion to the film that includes a new performance of one of Wilson's best ballads, The Warmth of the Sun.
What good is the dawn that grows into day? The sunset at or living this way, for I have the warmth of the sun within me at night.
Within me at night,
the love of my life.
Don Was has always been a fan of Brian Wilson's work. He met him at a party in 1989, and they became friends and even played some gigs together. But Don Was told me it was difficult to convince Brian Wilson to participate in a documentary.
Yeah, it was really hard, especially a film that was about his past. I mean, I think he's dredged that up one time too many, you know, for his own liking. And he'd also written about 40 new songs and was very anxious to record those and really wasn't all that excited about going back and redoing some of his older songs. What I explained to him, I gave him the my sushi defense. Which is that when you order sushi in a restaurant, they put some ginger on there to help you cleanse your palate in between courses. And I said, you need that. You've been the victim of this kind of bad publicity. And in order for people to approach your new music with an open mind, they need to cleanse, you know, the sordid details of, you know, aspects of your life, you know, from their memory and get reacquainted with what's great about your music. So he bought that.
Is that why your film focuses mostly on his songs as opposed to on some of the more tragic aspects of his life?
Well, truthfully, I'm a musician, you know. I'm a bass player. So I made a film about what I know. I wouldn't know how to begin analyzing his psychological treatment. I'm not even qualified to formulate an opinion about that. Or, you know, for example, I mean, what I know about is music, and I thought, that's what, let's make a film about Brian's music, and we'll deal with his life to the extent that it impacted his music making.
Were there conditions that he or any other members of the family gave you before they agreed to participate?
No, it was wide open.
What impact has Brian Wilson's songs or his production style had on you as a songwriter or as a producer?
Well, a phenomenal impact. I think he's the guy who broke out of that 3 or 4 chord kind of structure and really started taking rock and roll songs to highly unconventional places, melodically and structure-wise. He threw out all the rules about composition and was, you know, really creative with that. I think what he did in the studio, especially considering that, you know, there weren't even synthesizers back then. So in order for him to create a new texture, he had to get a bunch of guys. He would say he'd have a harp player and a harmonica player and a guitar player and a clarinet player. And he'd say, all right, all you guys play the same note. And he would create a new texture out of these 4 sounds, you know, playing in unison. Well, that's essentially what sampling's all about, you know, but there were no machines to do that then. You know, now you just do that in a keyboard, and that's where all these new textures come from. But he realized that you could you know, paint with some new colors, and he was the first to do it. He really is the first rock and roll impressionist.
Now, you grew up in Detroit, and I know you really loved a lot of black music when you were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
My guess is that the Beach Boys might have sounded really white to you, and mm-hmm. that maybe you didn't like them that much when you were young.
Well, you know, I did like them a lot. This is something I've come to realize. Brian was heavily influenced by the Four Freshmen.
Oh, yeah, you can't get any whiter than that.
You can't get it. That's pretty white stuff. But really, if you go back and analyze the harmonies, to me, they're like descended from Duke Ellington. It's really, it's cleaned up, but if you're just, you know, going to go in there and look at the notes and the harmonic structures of the voicings, they're pretty hip, actually, and rooted in, you know, I think Billy Strayhorn and Duke Ellington, so... You know, there's, you know, really, if you're making any kind of pop music in America today, there's no getting away from the influence of black music through the years. So, you know, maybe there's a tie in there. But I am a white guy from Detroit, so of course I like the Beach Boys. You know, it's just, the whole imagery of the, you know, I think that was it. As a teenager, I didn't really know how to analyze musically what was happening, but the imagery of the California dream, the whole surfing, driving a Woody, and the blonde girls on the beach, that, you know, what could appeal more to a kid who's, you know, landlocked in this auto town?
Pick a song for me that maybe sounds different to you now than it did when it first came out. Maybe sounds better to you now than it did when it first came out. You see more, you hear more in it.
Well, a good example, there's a song that we perform in the film called Till I Die, which I thought was, you know, a fairly depressing song at the time about a guy going through a bad time. What I subsequently became enamored of was the chord changes. When I had to perform the song with Brian, I wrote out a chart of the music, and I looked at this thing and I said, man, this is in no key. It starts in D, but it moves in a really bizarre cycle of chords. It's kind of reminiscent of, you know, Giant Steps, the John Coltrane song, but even more complex. And, in fact, I asked him about it. I said, how do you write something like that? What are you thinking when you sit down at the piano and you start going to all these unlikely places? And he said he was looking at his fingers and arranging his hands in interesting geometric patterns while trying not to move the highest note and the lowest note. And I thought, wow, what a wildly skewed method of songwriting. I mean, who would think of that? But that's the beauty of that's why he's a genius, because he could approach something like that from such a different place. It's kind of Zen songwriting in a way, isn't it? He goes in with this beginner's mind, no preconceptions about what a song should be, and he looks at the patterns of his hands.
Well, Till I Die is featured on the CD mm-hmm. that you produced with Brian Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Should we hear that?
Let's.
Rolling over.
What was it like for you knowing that you were going to go into the studio with Brian Wilson to produce recordings by him, given how much you admire his own production style? I mean, did you have to figure out what you thought was the best sound for him?
I had to figure out what I was supposed to do, you know? I mean, he's the greatest
right.
producer of all
he's
time.
He's the genius of production, yeah.
What do you want me there for? You know, I found a little role for myself in there, but I was just, I wanted to watch him work, you know? It's a voyeuristic learning experience for me, you know? It,
yeah, what did you learn from watching him, from working with him?
Well, just to... you know, it's this kind of Zen thing, just having an open mind. Listen to the sound in your head and try to capture that on tape, and don't have any preconceived notions about what it's supposed to be, or what the, you know, whether what the radio's going to think about it, or whether it's a commercial song or not. Just hear the sound in your head and go after it.
Did he go in knowing exactly what sound he wanted, or did you both tinker a lot while you were there?
He's really amazing. There's another song that we didn't put on this album, a new studio recording. He had an idea for an arrangement on the Creedence Clearwater song, Proud Mary. It's a really weird take on the song. And we went into the studio. We actually did it before we made this film. And it was the first time that he'd gone into a room of maybe 13 musicians who were waiting there for his direction since the 60s. It's how he made all his records, through Pet Sounds, and then synthesizers came in and he got used to overdubbing and everything. So he walked in, and here these guys didn't know, you know, what to expect of him. And the first thing he said was, okay, now in the middle of this song, we're going to stop for 25 bars, and I just want the drums to play quarter notes on the hi-hat. And everyone looked at him like he was out of his mind, because 25 bars of nothing in the middle of a record it's excruciatingly long. It's like a minute and a half of nothing, you know? And we thought that, all right, we'll go along with this. I don't know what he's talking about. We can always edit it out. And man, he knew every note that was supposed to be overdubbed on top of that minute and a half. And as he started doing the overdubs, it became clear that the whole thing was planned out. He couldn't take the time to explain it. You just had to make that leap of faith with him.
How come you didn't include it on the CD?
You know, we never finished it. It's also, the CD is the soundtrack from the film. The performances that are in the film make up the CD. And in fact, Brian had wanted to put some new material on there, but I said, "Yeah, save it. You know, this is a very specific thing from the film."
My guest is Don Was. His documentary about Brian Wilson just came out on video. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with record producer Don Was. He directed the documentary about Brian Wilson, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. The movie is so much about Brian Wilson's approach to songwriting and producing. Some of my favorite parts of the movie are about Brian Wilson alone at the piano, kind of demonstrating his approach to songwriting. Mm. There's even a scene in it where he sings with his mother, mm-hmm. singing backup, and his brother Carl.
Right.
Doing backup. I think the song is In My Room.
They did In My Room together, yeah.
How did you get them to do that? I mean, I don't imagine he still
know.
Sings with his mother a lot.
They hadn't done that in, I'm sure, 35, 40 years, you know, since they were little kids living at home. I think it's probably symbolic of the attempt that this fractured family is making to, you know, heal old wounds and, you know, reconcile with each other. It was a really poignant moment.
So did you ask them to do it? Did you try to encourage them to get together?
Yeah, I thought it would... what I actually see, I'll tell you truthfully, what I see in there is not only three people who've really been through it with each other making a real genuine effort to hold it together, but also you can, in the nuance, you can see what pulled them apart. You can see the forces at play that made the family crumble. It's in an impressionistic sense, it's the whole story right there. You almost don't need the interviews.
Well, I love this part here. Can we play this excerpt of the film with Brian at the piano singing lead and his brother Carl and his mother?
Sure.
Doing backup in my room.
In this world I look out all my worries and my cares in my room. In my room, in my room.
It's an excerpt from the new film directed by Don Was called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times, a film about Brian Wilson. Was it tempting to produce a record with him just like this, just like in his living room at the piano?
It almost is that. You know, I think that the performances were it was a really informal setting. You know, as you can see in the film, with people sort of in a semicircle looking at each other and not, no headphones, no baffles or anything like that.
One of the songs that you include in the film is Caroline No.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk to Marilyn Wilson, Brian Wilson's first wife, about her reaction when she heard this song. I think I'll play an excerpt of what she has to say from your film.
Great.
Where is the girl I used to know? I just really took it personally. How did you lose that happy glow? Well, I was like telling him off all the time and getting mad at him because he was being, very naughty. It's such a great song. I mean, the way he sings it with that whine that only Brian has with that wonderful voice. And then the ending, that, oh, Caroline, no. The way he goes, no. Oh, God, it's killer.
It really moved me hearing that. I loved what she had to say and how personally she took the song, even though he didn't write the lyric.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of those lyrics, if you talk to Tony Asher, who was his co-writer in that period of time, Tony said that Brian would basically come in and talk about what was on his mind and give Tony a feeling, a mood, a topic, and Tony would expand on it. I feel that Pet Sounds is it's weird because it's an extremely personal record. That knowing Brian, I understand that these are important emotional components of his being there, and yet the lyrics were actually written by someone else. But I think that they were based on sentiments that Brian was expressing.
Is this song one of your favorites?
Oh, I love that one. I also love his interpretation of it now. On the original version, he sings in this kind of innocent choir boy voice, and I think it's much more expressive now because you hear, that this is a guy who's been through the ringer. You hear a kind of world weariness in his voice, and yet you also hear this naivete and innocence that characterizes his personality. It's a wild juxtaposition.
Why don't we play the new version, which is featured on the CD, on the new CD.
Great.
This is Brian Wilson, Caroline No.
Where did your long hair? girl I know.
My guest is Don Was. His documentary about Brian Wilson just came out on video. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Back with musician and record producer Don Was. He directed the documentary about Brian Wilson, I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. You include in the film, and I'm glad to say on the new CD, a song of Brian Wilson's that was never released before.
Mm.
And this is, I guess, a home recording that he made
yeah.
in 1976.
Yeah.
The song is called Still I Dream of It. I really like this a lot. And, of course, you know, the recording's a little rough, but I love hearing that kind of demo recording.
Oh, yeah, I think it's really effective, yeah.
Tell me why this reached you and how you found the demo.
Yeah, it was, you know, a lot of his work is bootlegged. There's a real network of Brian Wilson fanatics out there. And somehow it came in. I don't know how I got a hold of it. I thought it was incredible. I think it's an amazing song. This is a period when he was supposedly not getting out of bed and was in, you know, dire emotional straits. And yet I think it's one of the best songs he ever wrote. It starts with some of the most mundane lyrics ever in a rock and roll song. And you think, oh boy, this guy's gone. And within about a minute, he's dealing with some of the most profound metaphysical questions posed to man, and it's brilliant the way he moves from that, from the simple to the complex, and makes it seem so natural.
Did he write the lyric for this?
Yeah, he wrote the whole thing himself.
Why don't we hear it?
Great.
This was a demo recording made in 1976.
Time for supper now. Day's been hard and I'm so tired, I feel like eating now. Smell the kitchen now, hear the maid whistle a tune, my thoughts are fleeting now. Still I dream of it, of that happy day when I can say I've fallen in love. And it haunts me so, like a dream that's somehow linked to all the stars above.
Did Brian Wilson mind you using a demo?
No, he never objected. No, I don't think so. He tried to. In fact, he did record the song with an orchestra. And if you buy the, there's a box set out on Capitol Records with a lot of never-before-released songs, and this is one of them. I don't think he came close to the emotional impact of the demo and the final recording. It all kind of got washed away in a slick sea of strings.
You've produced records by really successful records by a lot of people, including Bonnie Raitt, the Rolling Stones, the B-52s, Bob Dylan. Now, I understand that you're often not in the control room. You're in the studio with the performers.
Right. Yeah.
What's the advantage of that?
Well, there's a very practical thing. First of all, you know, if people are using headphones in the studio, it sounds really different than, you know, the way it sounds coming through these, you know, huge speakers that are blasting in the control room. And I think you need to be in the space that the artist is in. You know, I think you need to hear what they're hearing. So I sit out there with the headphones on and listen to that. But also, I like to be in there with the band. If, you know, everyone should be looking at each other. I don't believe in overdubbing too much. I think that the band should be there. I care less about bleed through of acoustic reflections than I care about eye contact. I like to have everyone in the same room. And you get this kind of open communication going. I think that a band that's listening to a singer will do certain things in response to what the singer does that the singer will then feed off of and respond to. They keep feeding each other, and ultimately you want to elevate through communication to a more expressive record.
When you're not playing on a session and you're just producing it and you're in the studio with the performers as they're playing, isn't it sometimes uncomfortable to make eye contact with them?
Well, I don't mean you stare Mick Jagger down while he's...
I didn't mean to stare him down, but I know, like, when I'm doing a concert with somebody in the studio here, mm-hmm. like someone's at the piano singing and or they're playing guitar or something, mm-hmm. I'll often just, like, walk out of their line of vision so that they don't have to worry if they look up, they'll be making eye contact with me, and it will seem as if there's something personal happening in the song.
Well, you know, so a lot of times I close my eyes because it can be really deceptive. For example, take a guy like Mick Jagger who... when he's doing a vocal on a record, is holding the microphone. Now, it's not on a stand. He holds it and moves around like he does on stage.
Mm-hmm.
But he's 5 feet away from you. It's the greatest show on earth. And yet you don't want the fact that it looks cool and you're enjoying it to temper your evaluation of the performance.
Right.
So sometimes if you take the visuals into consideration, it'll deceive you. So I close my eyes and try to perceive the way it's going to work recorded.
Done Was recorded last August. He directed the Brian Wilson documentary I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. It just came out on video. The companion CD is also called I Just Wasn't Made for These Times. Done Was just finished producing a new Rolling Stones album that has not yet been released. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Bentham, Joyce Lieberman, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
I was sitting in a crummy movie with my hands on my chin. All the violence that occurred like we never win. Love and mercy, that's what you need tonight. So love and mercy to you and your friends tonight. I was lying.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Penguin Books, publisher of Penguin Classics, for 50 years the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.